You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Richard Pryor is considered one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time. He's been described as outrageous, fearless, provocative, profane, angry.
Well, our next guest co-wrote a biography of Richard Pryor with his brother, David Henry. We have with us now Joe Henry. He is co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Joe is also a singer-songwriter. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds as though you sort of got interested in Richard Pryor. At least the whole thing sort of started for you with a song, Richard Pryor Addresses a Tearful Nation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the short version of the story, if there is such a thing, is that I wrote a song where I sing in first person as Richard Pryor. I didn't set out to do it. I just realized as I was writing it that that's who I believed was speaking. And I don't mention his name in the song. The title tells you how to hear it as him. And because I was on a record label at that time that was owned by Disney, and they were terrified of any exposure where Richard was concerned, because he's always been such a hot-button, volatile character, they insisted that I either change the title of the song, which I wouldn't do, leave it off my record, which I was not going to do, because I had recorded it with the legendary jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman, and it was significant to me, or get Richard's permission. So I set out to do the latter, and in so doing, I met him and became friendly with both he and his wife, ex-wife then, but then they remarried. She was wife number 5 and 7, Jennifer Lee. And I released the record, and Esquire magazine asked me to write a piece for them about Richard and how the idea of him led me to work with the great Ornette Coleman. And based on that piece, which was Richard and his wife found very moving, they asked me if I would write a screenplay based on his life. And I, of course, said, I'm not a screenwriter, I'm a songwriter. And they said, we know, we don't want a screenwriter. So I said, well, if I'm going to take this on, I'm going to get some help, and I'm going to ask my brother to help me, because he is a screenwriter, and we've always talked about doing something together. So we spent about 2 years completely on spec, writing a screenplay that we finished and was very close to being made into a film, and then the plug got pulled on it, as often happens. We sort of went away licking our wounds for, you know, a couple of years maybe. And then one day my brother David said, you know, we've done all this research and we've put all this thought into it. Who knows what will happen with our script? Let's just write a book. And, yeah. and so we did.
And that's the book we have today. Well, so obviously, you know, going back to when you wrote that song, you know, Richard Pryor had been pinging around in your head for a while. So there's obviously something about him that resonates for you. What is it? How would you describe your draw to him?
Oh, his, you know, beautiful, flawed, fractured humanity. I've always been attracted to artists, you know, who unveil that so fully and unselfconsciously to a point. I saw him on TV the first time, maybe I was, you know, 11 years old, and I just reacted to him. You know, the beautiful thing about hearing things and witnessing things when you're when you're very young, is that you don't know that you're being influenced, and you're very vulnerable to being influenced because you don't know that you have to make sense of it, or you don't ask yourself, you know, why does this mean anything to me? You just sort of go with it, you know, when it happens. And I sort of discovered Richard for myself about the same time that I discovered Bob Dylan. And, you know, they've both been with me ever since because, you know, Bob, like, has been a big deal for me as a songwriter, as he has been for most, you know, American folk-based songwriters of my generation. And Richard was there right alongside in that same moment, you know, giving evidence to what it means to be an artist who makes their whole heart completely available, even when it isn't pretty.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone would have had an excuse for having a life that was, you know, a complete wreck without redeeming value, it would have been Richard Pryor. He was born in a brothel. He struggled with addictive episodes throughout his entire life. He almost killed himself by self-immolation. And this is a guy who struggled with a lot, and yet he came out of that and became this edgy voice that was sort of speaking truth. Can you talk a little bit about how he came out of that background, living in this brothel, to emerge as a comedian on the scene?
Well, a lot of people, you know, survive absolutely heinous upbringings. I mean, I don't know if I've read about many lives that were as disastrous as Richard's upbringing was. And, you know, none of it his fault. You know, he was abused in every way that a young person can be abused, and grew up in just the most wicked circumstances. And yet, the people who actually survive that and find a voice are offering a tremendous amount to the rest of us, because, you know, we all grow through the collective experiences of others, you know. And I just think that he, you know, he was a rare person that was able to maintain that balance for, you know, longer than it, you know, seemed possible in some ways, between being the walking wounded and finding, developing, and maintaining a platform from which to speak. You know, there are people who are seriously hurt in their soul and don't know how to articulate that into some creative way that might offer something of value to others. There are some people who are beautiful technicians as far as artistry is concerned, but who don't have the soul to offer an audience that might be so moving as Richard's was.
I think it was Bob Newhart. I could be wrong about that, but I think he was the one who said that Richard Pryor drew the line between tragedy and comedy thinner than anybody else did. He seemed like he was incredibly vulnerable when he was out there on stage, and we have a clip that sort of illustrates a little bit about that. Let's listen.
I hope you think what I'm going to do is funny and laugh at me. I'm a comedian. And, yes, I'm a comedian. And I just like to relax because it's early in the morning and I'm sleepy. I don't want to fight or nothing. I just want to be mellow. I'm not a fighter. Never could fight. I had the moves, but I couldn't fight. The hitting part scared me.
Just a little clip there of Richard Pryor being kind of naked on stage about himself. Was that typical for him?
I think it was very typical. I mean, I think no great art happens without incredible vulnerability. I think that's absolutely a fact, as we now know it. And when Richard stood up, as he frequently did in his early days, and began his routines, as you just evidenced, saying, "I hope I'm funny," I think he really was hoping that people were going to not only find him funny, but find him acceptable. I think that's really what that meant when he said that, that he was offering himself, and he'd been told his whole life that he was without value. You know, when people grow up being so marginalized and maligned and hurt, I think it's really hard to ever believe in your own worth. And I think you hear that all the time, but I think that's also what made him so gifted, as to be able to stand on a stage and reflect back not only his own experiences, but, you know, the faces of others. Because, you know, what's funny is what's true. People laugh when they recognize truth in what somebody shares. That's a historic fact. The laugh of recognition is what that really is. And Richard had an uncanny ability to stand up in front of audiences, for instance, you know, black and white audiences, and challenge them and not offend anybody, because he was so vulnerable and he was so charming that no matter how he challenged audiences, rather than getting angry, people would say, "That's right, that's what we do, that's just how we are." You know, mm-hmm. When he would dress down a white audience, coming from anybody else, those same words might have been wildly offensive. But he did it with such heart, and he had such love in his soul, damaged as he was, that people could take it in. People wanted to take it in. And that's an incredibly rare thing.
We're talking right now to Joe Henry, co-author of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him.
We'll continue the conversation in a few minutes. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with Joe Henry right now. He's the co-author with his brother David of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Now, we talked about the vulnerable side of Richard Pryor. He also had this incredibly edgy side. I mean, he was right there looking over the cliff at the edge there. He used language that was difficult. He talked about race. He was very honest. And I wonder, at that time, how unusual was what Richard Pryor was doing, especially in the way that he changed the conversation about race in America?
Well, I think it was as unusual then as it would be now to see somebody stand up and speak truth with that kind of clarity. And by the way, when you say, you know, we look at one side, you know, the vulnerable side, and now we talk about the edgy side, I don't personally think those are separate sides. I think his edginess is a direct result of his intense fragility. Coming from the world and from which he came, I think, you know, erecting a persona that was edgy and tough in any kind of a way was a direct result of protecting himself, because he was in fact so vulnerable. But he was a revolutionary, and he was the most subversive kind, because people didn't recognize him necessarily. His audiences didn't know how to see him as a revolutionary in the real time of that moment. He's making them laugh, and he's exposing them to thought that they had maybe never taken on, and opened their minds in many ways. And that's a particularly deft thing to do when people don't know that you're doing it.
And so he's out there, he's being vulnerable, and he's using the N-word on stage a lot. How did people take that at the time?
Oh, about like you'd imagine. I mean, certainly when he was in his early days coming up in the Chitlin circuit, and in the early days of the nightclub years, which were pretty rough, and people were sort of, you know, reinventing and themselves and a form in real time, I'm not sure it was unusual to hear a man in that context use the N-word, but the fact that he somehow launched himself onto the mainstream stage in front of white America and continued to talk the same way he had always talked, that was shocking. People weren't used to that. At the same time, though, I think it's really interesting to note that when he went on TV, for instance, his very historic appearance, episode 7 of the very first year of Saturday Night Live, you know, I think a lot of people wondered, you know, if he's got to clean it up for TV, will it still work? Well, if you go back and watch that episode, which is available on DVD and on YouTube, you know, he's cleaned up his language, but none of the energy or none of the depth of his content is lost. You know, he had to shift his rhythm a little bit, perhaps, but nothing he was offering is diminished, which I think is fascinating, because so many people associate, you know, his edginess with his bad language. And, of course, that's a big part of his cadence. He punctuated his routines with the language of the street. But what was really edgy about him, you know, were the ideas.
Looking back at his career, you know, you and your brother have researched it exhaustively. What do you think is the pinnacle of his career, or the moment where you really feel like that is Richard Pryor distilled, you know, down to an essence? This is it.
Oh, for me, and I would recommend it to anybody who might be entering the stream, you know, sort of anew, the original Richard Pryor Live in Concert, the 1979 film that was recorded at a concert in Long Beach, is still the greatest single stand-up routine ever filmed. You know, you get a man alone on stage for an hour and 10 minutes or something, you know, a stool, a microphone, and a glass of water, and he talks about everything that matters, you know, love, death, sex, God, you know, religion, race, his mortality, his family, his upbringing, the, you know, the police, celebrity. It's unbelievable how much ground, you know, how broad a canvas he paints. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen it, and I'm never not sucked into it if I revisit it. I think that's sort of, you know, I'm not saying he didn't do work that equaled that, but if you wanted to see in a flash, you know, the breadth of his artistry, it's all right there.
We don't have that particular clip, but I do want to remind people just how funny he was. Let's listen to this.
Did you see The Exorcist? Yeah. See, the movie would have been over for me. If I'd have been in the movie, it would have been over. If I'd have walked in the house and heard, "Run!" That would have been it. Wouldn't have had to go no further. Right, with all the extras? No, no, no. Brothers exercise the devil every day, though, with two words. Be cool. Because the movie would have been over, right, if it had been a black man in the movie, because you don't be vomiting on no brother's clothes.
Little bit of everything there in that clip from Richard Pryor. What do you think about that one?
Oh, I always just, you know, I always have a smile on my face when I hear his voice. You know, there's a certain light in his delivery to me, especially from that era. You know, he's so buoyant in a way. You know, I just, I'm a sucker for him. What can I tell you?
So one thing we know about Richard Pryor, we know he was a revolutionary. He was incredibly funny. We also know about his substance abuse problems. And he talked openly about them. I remember seeing him on TV, actually, I think when I was a kid sometime, and he was, maybe it was Barbara Walters or someone interviewing him about the time he tried to, I guess, kill himself. He set himself on fire. How do you think he processed that? And then kind of, how did it come out the other side in his art as a comedian?
He never did really come out the other side. I mean, it's sort of the one thing that he was never completely honest about. You know, he got on stage and he was brutally honest about everything in his life, except, you know, he always talked about his drug use very candidly, but always as if it was in the past. And it was never really in the past. You know, from the mid-70s on, he talked about how foolish he was when he used to do cocaine. And, you know, he was as deep in it at that moment as he was ever going to be. That's just a fact. I don't think he really was free of it until his MS had crippled him to the point where he was strapped in a wheelchair and unable to use his body, and would have been powerless to use without the intervention of someone else.
And you met him at that time, right? He had MS by the time you met him.
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, people ask me all the time. They read, you know, a press release from my publicist and say, you know, you knew Richard Pryor. Well, I did spend time with him. But at the time that I knew him, I have to say that, you know, at that point he was strapped in a wheelchair and, for the most part, unable to speak any longer. Though, you know, I maybe heard him say two words in the, you know, three, four, five times I was at his house for an afternoon. And yet you look in his eyes and, you know, I knew he was there. I mean, he was mentally there, which was sort of shocking and heartbreaking to realize in some ways. But there was something very mysterious about it too, because I would get home from visiting him on an afternoon, and I would take music for him to listen to. He was a great lover of jazz, as I am, and I would sit and talk to him and play records or whatever. And by the time I got home, I remembered the afternoon as if we'd actually been conversing somehow. It's a strange thing in, you know, to think back on that and wonder, you know, I really felt as if we had been having an exchange, not just me talking at somebody. And of course I never knew him any other way. So that's just a kind of a strange, you know, human phenomenon that there are more ways to converse than just verbally, you know, as we know.
We're out of time, but Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, and I thank you for your time.
We've been talking to Joe Henry. He is co-author with his brother David of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. It was released yesterday.